This is the Reason Podcast, and I'm your host, Nick Gillespie. Please subscribe to us at iTunes and rate and review us while you're there. Few politicians have made more of an impact on their times than Arizona Senator John McCain, who is battling brain cancer. His new and almost certainly final book, The Restless Wave, Good Times, Just Causes, Great Fights, and Other Appreciations, has just been published and is already making waves. The 81-year-old former prisoner of war and torture survivor talks frankly about Donald Trump, the mainstream media, and his congressional colleagues. Throughout his career, McCain positioned himself as a centrist and a straight talker who pushed for campaign finance laws and military interventions that typically put him at odds with libertarians, even as he was friendly towards immigration and supportive of free trade. I sat down with my Reason colleague Matt Welch to take the measure of John McCain. In 2008, when the senator was the Republican nominee for president, Matt published McCain, The Myth of a Maverick, a tough but fair assessment that had its origins as a Reason cover story. No one is more qualified to talk about John McCain's life and legacy than Matt Welch. Let's get right to it. What are McCain's legacies, do you think, as a senator?
I think his most important or most impactful role is as a kind of hinge points of what happened to American foreign policy in the middle of the 1990s. So the end of the Cold War happens. There's talk of a new world order, but there's also a sense of American retrenchment, and we don't really know what's going to happen in the world. We don't know America's role.
This is the famous kind of vacation from history, right? Where we, you know, yeah. I mean, we had been at a war footing, both a hot war starting in the late 30s with Hitler, you know, through the demise of the Soviet Union in 91, 92, we had the peace dividend. So
it's an actual peace dividend. We cut military spending for basically the only time in your and my lifetime. And there was just, we didn't really know how things were shaking out. It's hard to remember now how fluid the world seemed back then.
I'm sorry to interrupt, but to set the scene more, especially yeah. because this in many ways is McCain's decade, like kind of really at the forefront of substantive policy discussions about foreign policy. But I mean, it's also kind of stunning, right, that in the wake of the Cold War, there were not many hot shooting wars. Obviously, there were, you know, issues in the Balkans and elsewhere, but I mean, it wasn't, and you have a lot of history and knowledge of Central Europe, but it was amazing that only one former communist country in Europe had a bloody revolution, right?
Yes, I mean, there on Russia's kind of a near abroad, there were a lot of terrible things happening in places like Abkhazia, and you know, there was bloodshed around the periphery, certainly in Chechnya and elsewhere. Yeah. It's kind of internally, depending on how you look at it. But basically, it was just Yugoslavia, and not only that, but there's peace breaking out all over Central America and South America and Africa. All the proxy wars kind of dried up, and so peace broke out. South Africa, places like that. So it was really kind of unsure what America should do, and McCain, by dint of Vietnam capture, and when he returned to America in 1973, he looked around and saw how divided the country was, and he started reading up on the war that, I mean, his dad prosecuted. Mm. Let's not forget that McCain, when he was captive, his father was in charge of the Pacific Fleet. It's an amazing thing to wrap your brain around. So he came back, saw a divided country, and he developed kind of a policy Vietnam syndrome. He was unsure about that America should be so propulsive out in the world. He opposed Ronald Reagan's deployment of troops to Beirut. He opposed Bill Clinton's smallish nation building exercises in Haiti and Somalia. And he said in 1994 about Bosnia that the worst thing that he could imagine right now is the idea of American boots on the ground in that country. It's the worst possible thing that he can imagine. And yet by 1998, he becomes the most influential Republican voice supporting Bill Clinton intervening, especially in Kosovo, but in Yugoslavia writ large. There was a change that happened right there. And that change mirrored, I think, a change in kind of the centristy approach in Washington towards American foreign policy.
But what happened then? I mean, because, what happened to McCain and what happened more broadly? Because the Clinton years were, I mean, it was kind of fascinating because on a certain level, he reaped the peace dividend that defense spending actually started going down under H.W. Bush. But he benefited from all of that freed up money going back into the real economy and whatnot. But at the same time, Clinton was very promiscuous. He was more promiscuous in his foreign policy than he was in his domestic affairs, I'd hazard to say. He had a lot of deployments of troops to different things. Why did McCain go from being, hey, what the hell are you doing in these shithole countries, if I can use a presidential phrase, to joining in, like saying, we got to go in with all guns blazing?
I think a couple of things happened to him personally and then also kind of to the country writ large. To him personally, he finally, after wrestling with it for 25 years, he finally provided meaning, attached meaning, created meaning to his Vietnam experience. And he also helped kind of the healing of Vietnam. He was a central figure in reestablishing diplomatic relations with Vietnam, along with John Kerry. He went out there. He helped install his one of his best friends as the first ambassador out there. He did the POW hearings, which is like the important kind of a precursor to having America do this. So he needed to heal Vietnam, and he wrote a memoir, co-wrote it with Mark Salter, called Faith of My Fathers, which is a remarkable book. And it had this, it imposed kind of this narrative onto his life. He was this, rebellious Tom Cruise maverick character straining at the leash of the expectations of his name, because he's the son and grandson of rear admirals named John Sidney McCain. And so he does this. He's rebellious. He's a screw up. He's crashing planes right and left. Gets into Vietnam, it gets broken, it records propaganda, is physically broken too. He's at the lowest point. He contemplates suicide and then realizes that it's this sort of ancient faith of my fathers, as he says, and to his comrades and brothers that he taps into. And at the end of the book, there's a really telling phrase. And this comes out in 1998, mind you, and this is right around the time that he turns on foreign policy. He's like, America lost her way for a while, but Vietnam should only be seen as an aberration. And now, we're back, baby. It's basically the last paragraph of the book. That was it. But let me just jump in but let's not forget also the world context at the moment. And Yugoslavia is the hinge point. Yugoslavia, grandma was getting shot on the streets, and I'm not laughing about that, in Sarajevo, pretty much nonstop from 1991 to around 1995. America more or less sat back and said, okay, Europe, what are you going to do about this? And Europe didn't do anything useful about it at all. And it was only when Clinton, I think with a lot of reluctance, got involved in 1995 and got the military involved, that Yugoslavia began to sort itself out. And so there's a sense of, well, the world isn't going to lead, and so America must. And that became a McCain position. It became a hawkish Democrat position. It became a media position. And that is where the center of American foreign policy shifted. And McCain was a key role because he was able to shout down the Jesse Helms, more kind of inward-looking isolationist, as it was called, foreign policy in the Republican
Party.
And
that helps to create that continuity, really, between his foreign policy and Hillary Clinton's in many ways, doesn't it?
Yeah. Very much. I consider them, and Al Gore, to a degree that's been totally whitewashed by history, but Al Gore was also a member of the Project for the New American Century. And in 2000, he gave while he was running for president, he gave a talk, I think it was at AIPAC, and it was just incredibly hawkish about the necessity of regime change in Iraq. So this just sort of became the default of where American policy had gone. And like a lot of hawkery, and sadly, and this continues to this day, people rarely have to ever say that they're sorry for either championing something that went really, really bad, or advocating, as McCain did in 1999, for an incredibly radical idea of rogue state rollback, as he called it, which is basically wherever there is someone who is, enslaved to a tyranny, we will back the rebels. And if the rebels are cracked down on, we will back them up militarily.
Wow.
Oh, my God. He ran on that.
Yeah. It's like an update of the we'll pay any price and bear any burden during the Cold War. The idea that we're going to go everywhere and define rogue states and then turn them into little Americas.
Yeah, and he was naming the countries too. It was basically Axis of Evil stuff, like North Korea, Iran, and elsewhere. And I mean, the template of preemptive war that George W. Bush, his vanquisher in the 2000 campaign, eventually championed after 9/11. That's a McCain template.
Wow.
His vision of like the neo people mislabel, I think, George W. Bush as a neoconservative. In 2000, there was one neocon running, and his name was John McCain. He was backed by everyone that we associate with neoconservatives, and like the guys over at Weekly Standard, Bill mm-hmm. Kristol and David Brooks especially. And it was only after 9/11 that George W. Bush looked around, who had run as more of a humble, realist type guy, turned around and said, okay, who's been talking about this stuff? And it turned out to be all of McCain's pals.
So what about the national greatness stuff? Did that factor into McCain's Senate career in any way? And if I'm remembering, and please, I mean, you literally wrote the book on McCain, so correct me. But wasn't it in the late 90s also? And again, there was this sense that America, you know, it's hilarious, but America had been set free from history, and we didn't have to run the world anymore. We could take a breather. And there were people, I think, you know, and this included a lot of libertarians and a lot of people at Reason were like, oh, my God, we can actually go out and breathe now. We can come up from the bunkers and the foxholes and the trenches and get on with our lives and enjoy the Internet and build it out and create a future that we really, you know, that is filled with individual flourishing and freedom and technological innovation. But then there were those people, and McCain seemed to be one of them, who were saying, like, you know what, we're losing the thread of, the narrative thread of America as a great country that does great things. Is that involved in any of this type of thinking?
Absolutely. Absolutely. So in 1997, David Brooks and Bill Kristol co-wrote a piece, I think it appeared first in the Wall Street Journal, called National Greatness Conservatism. And in which it sketched this out, like, we need a grand project. We have to knit ourselves together. They reached back specifically for the spirit of Teddy Roosevelt, this sort of, you know, vigorous, going to find that frontier, going to bust the trusts, just going to be super robust about everything, right?
It's like Teddy Roosevelt, it's like the cheapest read, and I think a clean read of him is that he was a little weakling who grew up with asthma, and he spent his whole life overcompensating with what I think is rightly considered a toxic masculinity that he tried to project all over the world. So screw Teddy Roosevelt.
Yes. I mean, he has things in common with John McCain. John McCain was an Eastern swell who moved out west to find his populist.
So he's like Bat Masterson, like, or the early kind of lawmen who moved from like Passaic, New Jersey, and were wearing derbies and stuff, but pretending to be tough guys out in the West.
I mean, there was a book written in late 90s, early aughts about McCain by a Rolling Stone writer called Man of the People. Mm-hmm. And it's like, McCain grew up, and I say this with affection, yeah. But he grew up more or less around Washington, D.C. His dad, when he wasn't out serving in wars, was serving as a kind of a liaison on Capitol Hill. So he was hanging out with journalists, historians, and senators from an early age. He himself became a liaison after he came back as the most famous POW and all of this. And he's always had this instinctive disdain, some of which I could sort of share and empathize with the populist rabble on the right. And it's a mutual kind of thing. It's pretty curious that he actually won the Republican nomination. In fact, he did it by attracting non-Republican votes in 2008. That's always been part of his
What form besides, a kind of offensive war or rogue state rollback or being the world's policeman? What other forms did a McCain-esque national greatness take?
So his basic and the national greatness conservatism idea. So again, it was in 1997. There was a great immediate pushback from Virginia Postrel, yeah. our predecessor at Reason, who very presciently kind of tore it down. They immediately drafted this. So they reached back to Teddy Roosevelt, and then they drafted their modern day TR, which was John McCain. So he started gorging, and his grandfather came of age in Teddy Roosevelt's Navy. And this is when America's Navy went from a couple of, you know, puddle buckets to the Great White Fleet. And they're all under the sway of the military historian Alfred Mayer Thahan or Thayer Mahon or whatever. But that America will eventually supplant the British Empire by controlling the world shipping lanes, and that'll be great for freedom of democracy and whatnot. So this was the McCain family belief in business forever, except for he got shook in it in Vietnam, and only started coming free right as he's writing his memoir, thinking about running for president, and hanging out with the national greatness guys. So domestically, what this looks like is anything that creates cynicism is the enemy, because cynicism blunts our sense, our national sense of wanting to sacrifice ourselves for the greater good of America. This is McCain's great idea and role in life. And so he went out hunting for what makes people cynical? Well, the money that is spent in politics that causes people to vote against their stated interests is making people cynical. So I'm going to go after that. This is big M dash on that. That also dovetails nicely with the fact that his career almost ended because of a campaign finance scandal.
Right,
so there's a way to rehabilitate his image.
He was
image.
Part of the Keating Five, right, which was an SNL, a lot of money was sloshing around from Charles Keating to five senators. And would you say that his campaign finance law, which was shorthanded as McCain-Feingold, and which really put the screws to explicitly political speech? I mean, this is like it is amazing that, you know, anybody could take this seriously, much less senators at the very highest levels. But, you know, McCain-Feingold was a way of stopping political speech. Is that his biggest Senate, artifact, legacy, that he pushed through a really draconian campaign finance regulation law, which, you know, essentially made it harder for people to talk freely about politics?
Yes, his main success. He tried a lot of other stuff that was meaningful to him at some points, but then became unmeaningful when it got in the way of his political ambitions, particularly immigration reform. So when he wasn't chasing down, when he wasn't having to try to woo the populists that he didn't like, then he was a champion along with Teddy Kennedy, who his great long line, lifelong friend and kind of his, the other line of the Senate. He was going after immigration reform when that became inconvenient, like when he was running for re-election in 2010 against an anti-immigration guy named J.D. Hayworth. Then suddenly he's out cutting ads like complete the dang defense.
Yeah, well, let's
all this kind of embarrassing
segue stuff from his Senate career to his role as a presidential candidate. And that, the immigration issue is a good way to segue from one to the other. He had always been favorably disposed towards immigration, right, to people coming in here, including legalizing illegals or at least being friendlier and expanding immigration. He saw that as part of the American narrative. Is that right?
Very much so, yes. And he's always had a kind of a natural sense of tolerance. One of his best friends from Annapolis days was a Mexican-American. Some of his best, like most withering speeches is confronting what he sees as bigotry or some kind of xenophobia, particularly as it overlaps with military service and things like that. So he came up with that. The distinction with his presidential runs, pretty interesting. So he runs against George W. Bush in 1999, becomes the media's favorite Republican.
Really the maverick, right?
Because he's running against, he's calling George W. Bush the evil empire. He's describing Jerry Falwell and the religious right as agents of intolerance. So the media's laughing.
And
he's backing campaign finance.
Is this when he was also, this was the Straight Talk Express?
Yes, that's when he, I'm a dumb journalist like anybody else. That's what initially attracted me to the guy, because he sounds kind of funny. He cusses, he BS's with doesn't pass up too many drinks. He BS's with journalists. And he had this kind of, ever since the Keating Five scandal, which is, early 90s, he realized that one way to neutralize bad press is just to say, okay, turn on the tape recorder and keep asking questions until it's done. And so by 96, when he was a surrogate campaigner for Bob Dole, Michael Lewis, a very liberal journalist, was writing basically open love letters about how much he adored McCain. And this gets into one of his key roles and functions that's not legislative necessarily. It's more kind of psychographic. He, in addition to being this hinge figure on vaulting us towards a more promiscuous and interventionist foreign policy, but he's a great Vietnam healer because over the course of the liberal journalists around him had this guilt complex about Vietnam. Most of them either opposed it kind of in a late breaking fashion or, you know, tried their damnedest to not serve. And so he was this guy who provided a kind of sense of absolution, saying it's OK. You know, we all have to get behind, you know, get past Vietnam. Again, he's reestablishing relations and all these kind of things. So journalists who had lost that contact with both the common man and particularly the military man, which is something that Robert Kaplan has written a lot about, and I think well about it. Like the military class of human beings, for the most part, is separated from the journalistic class these days. And McCain was the guy who made that kind of all right. And so journalists would go up and sort of sniff his jock, for lack of a better term, because he was bathed in this kind of holy glow. And this is a legitimate and important role to play to kind of heal this.
Well, and it is, to his credit, McCain was, you know, when you think of he was in the Hanoi Hilton, right? The most infamous prisoner of war camp in North Vietnam. And for God's sake, I mean, the North Vietnamese have many reasons not to forgive America for, you know, real and imagined. But, you know, they have their own thing. But it did mean a lot, I think, for Americans as well as for North Vietnamese or Vietnamese people, for a guy who was publicly tortured and, as you mentioned, was the highest profile POW during World War, during the Vietnam War, to come back and say, like, he asked for forgiveness and he normalized ties with Vietnam, and he also allowed for a healing in America then as well, it seems.
Yeah. This is a very important role. But so for all of these reasons, and he was doing things in the Maverick Straight Talk days, like embracing cigarette taxes, these other kind of things. He was saying the tax cuts are wrong, that we need to we need to help out the poor more. So for all these kind of like, oh, my God, you know, he's telling the hard truths and saying these things that Republicans don't like, but journalists do. They all fell in love with him under his sway. The 2008 run is very different, because he recognized early on that he won't be able to win by running against the Republican Party. He's got to woo them somewhat, at least. And so he went and did it sort of a rapprochement with Falwell and the religious right.
Friendly with the religious right. I mean, I see him as like, you know, and obviously he and you write about this in your book and in subsequent writings, but where he cast himself as the kind of son of Barry Goldwater, even though he didn't have particularly good relations with Goldwater. But like Goldwater, he really detested the religious right.
Yeah, I mean, the joke that he would say, you know, the old joke about the religious right, they are neither, is a thing that he would say. But he kissed up to them in 2005 and 2006 in the run-up to his presidential run. He's suddenly decided he was after pillorying this idea in the 2000 run. He was saying, you know, maybe I'm open to anti-gay marriage constitutional amendments. I mean, John Stewart interviewed him early on in that cycle and said, you know, you're not going to crazy baseland, are you? And McCain's like, you know what? Sorry, I'm going to go there. So this and just the fact that he was running against a dreamy Democrat was the only period of time really where McCain started getting bad press because on a number of issues, ethanol, I mean, to just throw one out there, he was just like flipping himself. And so the guy who had sold himself as this big straight talker, even though he had also, and this is part of the way he's disarming the journalists in his memoirs, particularly the first two, The Faith of My Fathers and Worth the Fighting For, which came out in 2002, which is probably even a better book. He's very disarming. It's saying, you know what, I lied here, or, you know, I put my ambitions above those of the country at this moment in South Carolina when I talked about the Confederate flag, you know. So he's admitting his own missteps there, and which makes people think, oh, you know what, he's really with us, which is a phrase that Jonathan Chait at some point used like in 2006.
So, and now his 2008 campaign was pretty dreary. And obviously he, you know, eventually came out and said, God, you know, picking Sarah Palin, what a big fucking mistake that was. You know, and I'm not sure I agree with him on that point. But what, you know, I mean, he was kind of a captive of history, right? You're running against Barack Obama, who is, you know, generally inexperienced, certainly compared to McCain, but he's youthful, he's vigorous, he's black. He represents a future that I think people like McCain in his heart of hearts knew he had been fighting for in Vietnam and elsewhere, for an America that was young, vibrant, multi-ethnic, and welcoming. And then he becomes, he is the old guy. He's Bob Dole from 96.
He becomes Bob Dole.
Yeah.
The political science behind the 2008 election identifies the key moment as being the financial crisis, which happens in October, I believe, or September, late September, early October, and more specifically, the reaction by the two candidates and the perceived who's going to be better at it. America decided that Barack Obama was going to be better at the financial crisis. You'll recall, what did McCain do at that moment? He said, oh, let's suspend the campaign.
He suspended his campaign. I thought you were asking me the question because I think we were in the D.C. office as this was unfolding together, but he suspended his campaign and came back to vote for all of the massive bailouts that Obama also voted for.
Yes, he didn't have any ideas. Like, he said, Obama's like, okay, so let's sit around and talk about what we're supposed to do to respond to this. And he's like, I don't know. His big idea there was like, we need to nationalize all of the bad mortgages. His set of analytical tools about economic regulation and other things, with the very notable and important exception of he believes broadly in free trade and the post-war trading order, and he also thinks that entitlements need to be reformed. Both of those, I think, are true and good, and he was good on those, but almost everything else, he wanted a very vigorous kind of sense of regulation. He never worked in the private sector except for about a year working for his second wife's family's beer distributorship.
Please
in Arizona.
Tell me that he made at least half a dozen appearances as Budman somewhere in rural Arizona.
I think he was doing Spuds McKenzie back then. But like his toolbox, he was not grounded in anything like a sensible or even, you know, Goldwaterian economics. He wasn't. He didn't have any of those principles. I mean, you mentioned their relationship before. McCain never really understood why Goldwater didn't like him. And it bugged him for a long time. But Goldwater rightly identified that McCain didn't have many libertarian bones in his body. In his 2002 book, he says very explicitly, I appreciated that George W. Bush, like me, rejected that leave us alone libertarianism that was so widespread in the 1990s. He ran against all of that. And so when the push came to shove on, you know, a big thing happens, all he wants to do is press the big red do something button. And I think Americans looked at that. And they didn't have an alternative. Are you going to have the old guy do it or the young guy do it? So they said the young guy is probably going to be better on this. I think the road not taken that would have been interesting would have been what happens if you have a completely different sort of philosophy approaching that problem. He didn't take that. And I think it proved fatal to him.
Do you think he would have beaten Hillary Clinton in 2008 had she secured the election? The nomination, rather.
Yes. Yes, I do, because... it's always hard to run as a third term on a party, as we've seen many times here. I mean, the only one really to do it in my immediate memory is George H.W.
Right.
Bush.
Yeah, and
people,
before
people
him,
did not love it.
Yeah, before him, it was like Martin Van Buren. And, he's just a Seinfeld punchline at this point.
It's very difficult, but Hillary Clinton has just always been a very poor candidate at whatever mm-hmm. she has run for. And she had to, her best skill as a candidate is wiping out the competition before they run. But when it comes down to it, Rick Lazio gave her a run for money, for crying out loud, in New York. So I think the fact that people kind of instinctively like McCain and instinctively don't like Hillary Clinton would have made that interesting. And also there would have been less, let's not ever forget that Barack Obama won because of the anti-war vote. Parenthetical, so did McCain in the Republican primaries, as insane as that sounds. But really, that was the decisive role in the early primaries. People who were both independent and also explicitly anti-war, like, oh, McCain's one of us, even though there's no way, if you thought about it, that he was. But anyways, Obama had all the people who were fed up with Bush's wars and the civil liberty stuff. they could go to Obama. That's a contrast with where McCain was on most of those issues, although he was against torture. Clinton and McCain, there's not a lot of daylight between their foreign policies there, so the contrast would not have been as strong.
But he would have been seen as the authentic guy versus the faker.
Yeah, I think so. And you know, more at that point, more of kind of experience under his belt. She had not yet been Secretary of State.
Do you think that McCain contributed heavily to the sense of lassitude and kind of lack of direction of the Republican Party in the 21st century? It's interesting. You bring up how you remind us that Bush ran on a humble foreign policy, which we're already starting to forget given how things played out, and that McCain was more hawkish. But, you know, then you mentioned, so he supported American foreign policy, and he called towards, you know, till the end of his life, he was calling for more intervention in more places. And then at the same time, he had no tools for, you know, kind of how to manage the economics of the country during a financial crisis. Is he kind of one main reason why the Republican Party seems to be devoid of any meaningful principles or direction?
Yes. And he, I think, never really grappled with this. And very similar to how a lot of the kind of never Trump space in conservatism has never really grappled with their own culpability for fostering the kind of cynicism and even nihilism that is identified with the rise of Donald Trump. People lost faith, and rightly so, in the performance of their elites, because of the elite's performance, particularly in supporting the Iraq war, in contributing to the destabilization of the Middle East, and not, in Bush's case, in not managing Hurricane Katrina in anything like a normal fashion, in turning, you know, surpluses or paper surpluses into just massive debt and deficits, and then in helping build up the conditions for the financial crisis and bringing us out of that in a way that, you know, that has lagged behind almost all other recoveries in history and will probably build up another bubble again. So, I mean, in Chris Hayes has his book, The Twilight of the Elites, that kind of gets to this point, too. The elites discredited themselves. John McCain is absolutely part of that process. He's part of the process of untethering the Republican Party from even the memory of kind of Goldwater conservatism, with the exception of the way that Goldwater himself was sort of hawkish, or he's maybe more Jacksonian than neoconservative on it. All of that became untethered. McCain is part of that. And I think until people like John Kasich, who you might, you know, describe as McCain conservative, he's sort of, you know, very interventionist, but he tries to get along with journalists and reach across the aisle, sort of temperamentally centrist. He's also has an anger problem like McCain does, too. But these people haven't looked themselves in the mirror and gotten to their culpability. They're just more anguishing that things have gotten to this point, and so are issuing in McCain's final book, which I'm tearing through as we speak. You know, it's filled with bracing language, rejecting the small-minded authoritarianism and xenophobia of Trump world. And that's all to the great. It's just, where is the, like, whoops, you know what? Maybe we shouldn't have advocated for just nonstop surges. And let's help these freedom fighters who I just met last week at an arms depot somewhere in Syria.
So why don't you sum up kind of John McCain's cultural legacy or cultural importance? Because, you know, obviously his life was as a public person, both as a soldier and as a prisoner. But also as a legislator. I mean, this is a guy who, as you mentioned, really didn't work in the private sector very much. And, you know, and that's not a dig or anything. But he is also a kind of figure who seems to be vanishing from America. I mean, he's a warrior politician. I mean, somebody who served in an actual armed conflict that was really, you know, the fate of the world seemed to hold, you know, to be weighed in the balance there. He's an old guy. He served for a long time, and he reaches back to, you know, a different America. What's his legacy, not simply as a senator legislatively and not simply as a Republican or a presidential candidate? What do you think of his longer kind of cultural significance?
He belongs to an era which we kind of don't have anymore, in which it's possible to trust, even if it's misplaced trust, but it's possible to trust a politician. I think in many ways the the signature McCain moment, very interesting. It's, I don't know, 5, 6, 7 days after 9/11. We're all just wrecks as human beings, as a country. And he goes on, I think it was, it could have been The Daily Show. It might have been The Tonight Show, some big late night thing. And it was one of the first episodes back. And they didn't go to George W. Bush because, you know, we still didn't know what to think about that guy. He won an impossibly divided election. A lot of the left, you know, hated his guts and all this kind of stuff. But people kind of inherently trusted McCain. He became our national grandpa or uncle at that moment and legitimately helped kind of soothe us and tell us that everything was going to be OK, or at least just tell us that there's going to be people out there who we trust their motives. That trust in many senses is kind of misplaced. And McCain is a figure who exemplifies one of the problems in our political class and journalistic class, which is that we think that just having our hearts in the right place, identifying the people that we want to help and pressing the do something button is sufficient always. And we don't spend enough time asking ourselves, well, is this the right thing to do? Is this the constitutional thing to do? Can it produce unintended consequences? Now, those are discussions for later days. In that moment, we felt like we could trust somebody. And of all the people in America, it was kind of John McCain more so than it was any identifiable Democrat or the president. That's kind of the role that he played. But because he also, in that moment and in many moments, especially the last two decades of his career, because he wanted to press the do something button, particularly as it comes to interventionism, he helped create the conditions for which distrust was so high that we no longer have trust in figures like John McCain. It's sort of a Mobius strip kind of analysis, but I think that there's something to that. I appreciate very much his sense of honor, which haunted him his whole life. I mean, he's third generation out there, third generations. And I know this from my own family. We had a rear admiral, father, son, and my own direct descendant. And the third generation of that, he buckled under the pressure. John McCain was that guy. He almost buckled, but he didn't. And he felt really haunted by and honored by that sense of the honor code. He's instilled it among his own family, some of whom I know and am friendly with. He has, even though he had an anger problem, to be sure, there's an innate sense of decency about things that radiates around him and attracts people to him that I think is genuine and it's good. And I don't know where we will get people like that in the future. That's kind of an interesting anachronism. But at the same time, he should be a very teachable moment that that's not enough. It just is not sufficient to be someone who feels this, you know, a necessity and duty to serve and who speaks in very highfalutin language, even on issues and in moments that don't deserve the highfalutin kind of thing. His moral dudgeon, you know, he was always talking about existential threats to our way of being, and it could be steroids in baseball. It's like, right.
We needed a national boxing commission or something like that.
Yeah, right. I mean, he was against ultimate fighting, anything, again, that would sow cynicism, he was going to be against, and that took him to a lot of illibertarian places. And we shouldn't forget that either. And to the extent which he was, self-critical, disarming, and all this kind of stuff, I think it does his memory the best honor to be kind of eyes wide open about his own flaws and demerits and what we can learn from that to be a better kind of polity and better policymakers.
Let me, as a final note, float something by you. There's a kind of mediocre Vietnam movie called The Hanoi Hilton. That the controlling metaphor in that, and this is since I've seen it in other kind of Vietnam texts, is the biblical story about Isaac being sacrificed by Abraham. Or, you know, God says to Abraham, you know, give me your son from the Bob Dylan song. But it's like, you know, God says to Abraham, sacrifice Isaac, your long awaited son. Abraham is kind of like, what the fuck is going on? But yeah, you know, God said to do it, so I'll do it. And in the Hanoi Hilton and in other Vietnam stories, people often talk about how, you know, the draftees, the people who were sent to Vietnam were Isaac. They did not know why their fathers were telling them to go there, but they felt a sense of duty to lay on the altar and be sacrificed. I think about that a lot with somebody like John McCain. I mean, it's like really a powerful image. But kind of what you're saying is that he willingly put himself on the altar. He did what his country or what his fathers told him to do. And then he kind of replicated that because he ended up asking other people to sacrifice for things that ultimately went very wrong, or were not worth sacrificing for. And my question to you, Matt, I guess, is as the social type he is the ultimate teaching moment of John McCain's life that we need to stop thinking in terms of kind of intergenerational fathers and sons and sacrificing, blind obedience to sacrifice. And we need to come up with like, and it's not to dishonor his service and his past and his struggles and his decent humanity, because I tear up when I hear him at his best talking about immigrants and about the power of America and redemption and all of that. But like we need different types than John McCain offers.
Yeah, American exceptionalism has a tendency to kind of huff its own fumes, and it's very sad that he didn't apply whatever kind of mental kind of anguish and tumult that he experienced upon returning. Because remember, he returned from Vietnam and it spent a year at the Naval War College just studying, and a lot of it was like reading the Pentagon Papers which, to be clear, he volunteered to testify against Daniel Ellsberg at that trial, but that trial didn't come to pass. So he's not always cuddly and lovable when it comes to that issue. But so he gave himself a kind of tutorial on how he got involved in Vietnam. He stopped talking about the domino theory as being a thing, which he had stressed a lot in an essay he wrote for U.S. News and World Report in 1973. Later on, he's like, oh, there was no domino theory. So that's an interesting discrepancy. But he didn't have the intellectual curiosity, I don't think, to kind of learn from that. He wrote a book, came out 2007, I think, called Hard Call. And it was ostensibly about a bunch of different military leaders, political leaders who had to make a difficult decision.
This was like his Profiles in Courage, right?
Yeah, he's done a couple of books that are kind of like that, but it's sort of supposed to be like, okay, this is a difficult decision about the most important kind of life or death thing that you can come up with, and yet it still remained incurious about how do you go about making the decision to go to war or not, and what happens when you get that wrong. Especially about the Iraq War. He sort of like just said, well, we can all argue whether it was justified or not. But anyways, this guy was great. No, that's not enough. You have to actually ask yourself, did I support something that shouldn't have been supported? Or, as in the case of Yugoslavia, did I support something that had a good outcome on paper, but also led to kind of a series of precedent setting, a lowering of the bar of intervention that eventually gets us to Libya, which was an absolute catastrophe. He didn't have that sense of intellectual curiosity. We all need to have it, regardless of where we stand on the interventionism scale. War is such an incredibly totalizing, awful thing of all governments, policies, and programs. We should be the most cautious about it and the most skeptical about it. John McCain was for 25 years, but then in the rise of the moment and the reassertion of kind of America's leading role as the unipower in the world, he believed in it so strongly that he kind of started looking the other way. And I think we've all suffered from not just him in particular, but from the entire kind of political class marching along with him down that road in a way that was incurious and ultimately pretty damaging.
Wow. Thank you so much, Matt Welch. We have been talking to Matt Welch. He's editor-at-large at Reason. Read his stuff all over the place. Watch for him on TV. You cannot escape him. And while you are thinking about John McCain, read his book, McCain, Myth of the Maverick. Matt Welch, thanks for talking. This has been the Reason Podcast. Please subscribe to us at iTunes and rate and review us while you're there.